Good evening and welcome to another episode of the Perceptive Podcast here on Game Wisdom, where we examine the art and science of games. We have another great cast for you this week. I'm going to be following up with an indie developer we've spoken to several times here on the Game Wisdom Perceptive Podcast, as well as on our live cast. And we're going to kind of give an update about what's been going on with his first game, Bullock Mayan Warfare, and the work that's been happening with over the last, I think, year or so since we last spoke. So please welcome back to the podcast, founder of Ninja 5 and lead designer on Bullock, Trayvon Taylor.
Good evening, everybody.
Hey, Trayvon, it's great to have you back on. How are you doing?
I'm doing awesome. Phenomenal today.
Awesome. For those of you listening to this cast right now, we are recording this just at the start of September. So school's back in session for the younger audience here, but for us people outside, it's just, I guess, another day in our lives, right?
Just another day in our lives, man.
Yes. At least the heat wave, at least the summer heat wave, is finally starting to end. How is it where you're at?
Man, it was terrible. Like, a week of, like, 100-degree weather. Ugh. It was as if, like, it had to remind us that we were in August, and it just stuck up on us, and then that eclipse happened. I think that just made it even worse. But now the weather's cooled down. Now it's kind of cloudy out here. It looks like it's windy. It looks like it may rain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure it's probably going to rain around here, I think, really soon. But it's finally out of, like, the 80s and 90s. So that is great for me. But we certainly have a lot to talk about. And for fans who have listened to our previous talks with Trayvon, you know we can just sit here and chat for, like, 2 to 3 hours like it's nothing. So, we better get started. I guess, for folks who are new listening to this cast right now, could you, recap kind of your background, and what is Bullock Mayan Warfare?
Okay, cool. Like we said earlier, my name is Trayvon Taylor. I am the creative lead for Bullock Mayan Warfare. In Bullock Mayan Warfare, it's a mix between strategy and hack and slash, where you build your empire, while at the same time, you're actually fighting on the actual battlefield using magic and Mayan weaponry. You play as a Mayan warlord, and you're going from city to city, adding it to your territory. I went to college for game art and design, and then I ended up contracting with Apple for a few months, working on their 3D maps. Built, put the team together back in February, adding each person one by one, I guess like every 2 months. So now there's about a core team of five of us working on the project, with some of the people contributing to it as contractors.
And for the folks listening, when did you first start working on Bullock?
Bullock initially started as a senior project for me back in college. And then after graduating, I realized, I was like, well, I really want to make this into a video game. So I began putting the plans together maybe around late 2015. I started building the environments out. Around February, I started expanding and adding people to our team. One of our teammates, Stephanie, she used to be my coworker back when we were contracting at Apple. And then through her, I met Samuel. He's our programmer. And then there's Jeff Woodward. He's our animator. I went to college with him. And there's also Theron Green as well. I went to college with him as well. Mm-hmm.
And when we last spoke, for those of you listening to the cast right now, I believe the two of us, we've spoken twice. I think it was one time record, and then I think we did a live chatting. Was that like 6-7 months ago? Again, I've lost all concept of time with this.
Right. So last time we contacted each other was back in March before the sack in the arcade. Okay. That was actually crazy because the interview, I feel like it was kind of like three parts to it. I believe that the live cast, it was either the live cast or the recorded part was two parts, and then it was like one part. So it was crazy.
I know. We went extra long there, and we'll see how long we go tonight. But
right.
I know since we last spoke, you were, during one of our casts, you talked about the plans of taking Bullock to Kickstarter. And I know since we last spoke, things have changed, and we'll talk more about kind of your thoughts on Kickstarters and or your thoughts on Kickstarter and your plans for it probably later in this cast. But I do want to start off with kind of talking more about the design process for you and the rest of Ninja 5 with Bullock. Because as we have said many times on the Perceptive Podcast and on our live talks, one of the biggest challenges of game development is basically taking that game idea and iterating on it to the point where it can be a finished product. As I'm sure you're no doubt aware, Trayvon, there's a very big difference in designing in your head versus taking it to a computer and actually putting it in front of someone's eyes to play. So, I guess my first question for you is, since we've last spoken with the design that you've done with Bullock so far, how has things, I guess, transitioned from, again, the early concept or the prototype you were working on in college to where we're at right now?
Well, for starters, we're at that point now where we're implementing features. Because mm-hmm. in the past, we were caught between, and it's always a constant between creating assets versus making it functional. Mm-hmm. And we're referring back to our earlier notes when we first started adding features like, hey, here, you should be able to conquer cities now. Like, we've added that. You can conquer cities after beating the level. It's just implementing features that we've discussed earlier, as well as still creating content for the game. Mm-hmm. Since we last spoke, we've implemented a functional campaign map. So you're able to go from city to city and conquer them and add it to your territory. So when you conquer a city, it actually tells you, the game tells you that, hey, you conquered the city, and it shows your territory. So you can actually see progression within the game versus just doing combat arenas. Mm-hmm.
Now, I know when we were talking on Facebook a few days before the cast, we were discussing the challenges of, again, like the merging of the strategic layer and the combat layer together. Because for those of you, again, who didn't listen to our first cast, I'll include a link to it below. As you said, Trayvon, Bullock combines the strategic layer of kind of managing your empire, knowing or deciding what cities to attack and stuff like that. And then you have the action or beat-em-up style gameplay when you're actually in the field using whatever characters you've upgraded or skills you unlock to try and take over the city, which then takes you back to the strategic layer and so on and so forth.
Right. You initially start off with the campaign map. It's like an overview of the entire area, the Yucatan, the different regions over the Maya we're at. You start off with your city, Uxmal, for this faction, because there are four playable factions. Right now we're working on one faction called the Shu. They're in the middle of the Yucatan. So you start off with their capital, Uxmal, and then you must conquer other cities. Some cities are actually rebelled against you, while others are actually at war with you. So from there, you select which city you want to attack, and then your unit, the military unit, is represented by a warrior. You have it move over to the city or tile that you want to move to, and then you attack that city, and once you attack it, it loads the city, and you fight your way through waves of enemies. We also added the enemy unit now, where you must intercept them before they reach your capital. Mm-hmm. If you intercept them, you fight them on a battlefield, but not within the city. So we call that skirmishes, where you meet with enemy forces. The skirmish maps are smaller than the city maps, and they're a little easier, too. Mm-hmm.
Now, with the gameplay between the strategic layer and the combat layer, how has it been, I guess, playtesting and trying to figure out what to, I guess, focus on first with the design of Bullock?
Let's see. Like I said, we refer back to our notes from when we started, saying, like, hey, we want this in the game. So we're always referring back to that, and then we're creating the content, and then our programmer, he makes it functional. So after he makes it functional, he'll send it over to me, and then I'll play test through it. And based off of any errors that we encounter, I'll get back to him and say, hey, man, we need to fix this. And then we check back to our notes saying, hey, we need to add this onto it too to make it more complete, such as adding more combos, more spells. It's a back and forth process between me and our programmer, Sam. Mm-hmm.
And I know since we last spoke, or I think this was like after our first cast, you've, of course, sent out like pre-alpha builds to YouTubers and other people kind of check out. I know as of today of our recording, you said you're also going to be sending out the latest updated demo. I guess my question for you, Trayvon, is have you gotten like a lot of feedback from playtesters or people you've sent out to, and what did they think of Bullock so far?
So let's see, where do I start? With the YouTubers, we didn't really contact that many mm-hmm. initially. It was more of gamers, like people who just play video games, such as from the indie arcade, or people that we know personally who signed up through our email subscription list. The feedback we got was they said that they like it. They wanted more combos, more functionality on the campaign map. But for the most part, though, such as back in the indie arcade, people really, really liked it. So it was cool opening it up to the public. There are other game developers, too, who I've gotten feedback from. They'll tell me stuff about how to make the game more immersive, such as the sound effects. We actually have a sound designer now. His name is Douglas. He's really, really good. So we're implementing the sound effects that he's created for us, as well as other developer feedback on how to make the game more immersive, such as if you kill an enemy, have the body be there to make it feel like you're on the battlefield. Also want to throw in people in the background to make the city feel more alive. Just more immersion type of stuff. And then making the frame rate better too, like doing things to optimize it. Because this is a pre-alpha, like understand people, ladies and gentlemen, that this is an early pre-alpha build. So we're still working on the optimization. So frame rates might drop and stuff. Yeah. So understand that the product can look completely different from now in regards to how it functions or with the frame rate.
Yeah, and that's always one of the biggest challenges for any game developer, be it a major studio to an independent company, is knowing what are the best times or states of my game to show to new people. Because as you just said, Trayvon, and I'm sure any developer listening to this cast can also attest to, your game can radically change throughout its development cycle. And so this is especially true, or it's a lot more, I guess, cluttered these days with early access. Because when you're on early access, a lot of people see that as your game being, you know, mostly done, or this is what my game's going to be, you know, going forward. But when it comes to game development, these titles can change a whole lot. I think in a previous conversation I had with a game developer, we talked about how sometimes a game doesn't come together until maybe like the last 75-80%, and then you get like that magical, you know, all of a sudden everything just clicks, and it's like, oh my goodness, we have an actual game now.
Right, there are certain points during development where that magical moment, you're just like, whoa, this actually works. Like, in the beginning, it was a process of a lot of content creation, creating animations, getting the spells together. And then finally, it took us like, I think, 2-3 months before we were actually able to move the character through the game and actually fight enemies. So that was one magical moment. Another magical moment was when we upgraded. I don't know if you remember. Remember, Bullet looked way different when we first started. Like graphics-wise, we updated the graphics. It was like an overhaul with the graphics and the spells. Like some kind of like Skyrim mod or something. Or like, hey, Skyrim's coming to the PS4. Like that kind of thing, or one of those restore content type of things.
Yeah.
The other thing was recently when we put in our new combo system. You gotta understand, like before when we first started out, it was just a basic button mashing and then spells, right? And then we added it where you can do heavy attacks. But the problem we had at first, you couldn't really differentiate between the heavy and light attacks. They were kind of the same. So then we had this cool idea where we said, hey, what if on the heavy attacks, we made them look completely different? I'll give you a prime example with the spear. And this is like one of my new favorite weapons now. Actually, they're all my favorite weapons, man. With the spear initially. So light and heavy attacks were just you're stabbing with a spear. And we said, hey, what if for the heavy attacks, we have you swipe with the spear, right? Whereas like in real life, you know, I feel like a thrust with a spear would do more damage than a swipe with a spear, you know? But it's in the game now. So now if the player does a light attack, they're stabbing. Whereas if they're doing heavy attack, they'll swipe. And you can mismatch the combos too. That's the other thing too, Josh.
Yeah.
You can one moment spear stab, and then on the next one you're doing spear swipe, and you go back to stab. Like you're mismatching the combos on each weapon. We've added more to the greatsword as well. You can do a lot more with it. The Mach Wedel too. You're not just hitting with the Mach Wedel. That's the sword. You're also using the shield as well. So you're mismatching between slashing at people versus bashing them with a shield.
Mm-hmm.
So it's magical moments like that where it's like, whoa, we have a video game. And then there's the campaign map too. Actually being able to see the strategy layer, which we're constantly like, we're looking to improve that as well.
Mm-hmm. And getting the feel for combat is such a very tricky aspect. And I know we could probably turn an entire podcast into just that one topic in of itself. Because there is so much that goes into when you're building an action game that is designed around the player's skill being first and foremost the main form of progression, you need to get that to feel right. And that quote-unquote feel can be very different and difficult to do. Because I am sure you've played a lot of action games as well, that there's so much in terms of the difference between playing something like Bloodborne, versus Ninja Gaiden, or God of War versus Devil May Cry, and so on.
Right. You brought up a good point there in regards to the combat. Like, with this game, with Bully, it's not meant for the hardcore hack and slash beat 'em up nuts. Like, no, it's like a mixture between strategy and hack and slash. We wanted a game where you can, we've discussed this before, where you manage the empire, you feel like you're part of something really, really big, but at the same time, you get to see things through the eyes of someone on the battlefield. Like, when we first approached Bullock, it wasn't like, hey, our combat needs to be fast paced, you know, like God of War, or, hey, it needs to be more strategic, like Dark Souls. It was more like we approached the concept with, we want melee in one hand and magic in the other hand. So games such as Skyrim, Fable, Force Unleashed came to mind. Like, hey, melee in one hand, magic in the other hand. And then from there, so it kind of made the process harder at first because we went with that concept. And then from there, after playing with the combat, we're like, what can we do to improve our combat to make it feel like it's not just button mashing?
Yeah, and that is actually a really good point right there, Traylon. The difference between the feel of the combat, like what makes combat go from being just simply, I'm just mashing X or triangle for 10 minutes, versus giving it that rhythm and feel.
I'll give you an example. I'm glad you brought this up. This brings me back to one of my, a current issue I'm dealing with. Now, I love the game, The Old Republic, right? The Star Wars game, The Old Republic. My problem is this. I'm just hacking and slashing. I'm button pressing, right? The slash button, the different buttons and stuff, right? When you want to make something feel, in combat, it has to feel responsive, right? So, like, one of the things you do to make combat feel more responsive, you have the enemy react to each hit. Versus with, like, a RPG, like maybe The Old Republic, you're hitting the enemy, but the enemy, it just flashes red. Like, there's no indicator to, hey, you're actually, like, hurting the enemy. Like, yeah, the health might drop, but you're, like, continuously hacking away at their health, and there's really no indicator that you feel like you're in, like, combat. Whereas in certain games like, God of War, or even a fighting game, like, you hit the enemy, body reacts. Like, actually seeing the enemy react, actually hearing them react, like, they're in pain. Maybe you might see blood. It's just how responsive things are. And that goes back to content creation, too. Like, we created an animation for when you strike the enemy's body reacts to you getting, to them getting hit. Or we implemented a code where, hey, if the enemy gets hit, he makes a grunt sound. When you swing, you can hear the sword being swung. That kind of stuff. Those kind of cues right there, that makes the player, it's the difference between the player feeling like they're just mashing the button versus them actually being in combat. And it goes back to our combos too, switching it up.
Yeah.
Whereas you have the spear swipe and the spear stab, light and heavy.
And you can even see this in older games, like the old school beat-em-up genre. Like when you play a game like Final Fight or Streets of Rage, and you can see, again, it's not just you pressing a button. You're watching the character react. You're watching him go through his whole combo animation phase. And, of course, even games, or even like stuff like Streets of Rage had, like, advanced moves you could do, like unique combos for each character, or, like, the quote-unquote special move. It's more than you just staying there and pressing square for 20 minutes, and then you get the you win screen.
Right. You don't feel like you're just grinding through combat. Like, that's the difference. You want them to feel like it's an actual experience, not them just grinding through a story. And like I said, that was like one of the problems I was having with like The Old Republic. I'm like, I like this game. I like Star Wars, but I'm like, this is not working. Like, I love the Knights of the Old Republic. That one felt different. It was more of like visual cues and stuff, even though the graphics obviously look different. That's why I was like, maybe I should go back to playing Force Unleashed or something. But yeah, you don't want the player to, when the player starts feeling like they're grinding through, and people enjoy that stuff too, because that's why people play Pokemon. That's why people play like turn-based RPGs. Like, they like the grind and stuff. But someone like me, I don't. I prefer a game like Arkham City, or that's why I like Mass Effect as well, because it's not just an RPG, it's a shooter as well.
Now, I guess, I know we spoke about this, I think, the last time or the time before we spoke, but whenever we talk about games that mix genres or mix two different kinds of gameplay together, one of the big comparisons will, of course, be XCOM. So I gotta ask, have you had a chance to play the latest XCOM game?
Of course. That's actually... Oh, you want to talk about magical moments, Josh? I'll tell you about a magical moment. So our UI artist, Stephanie, right? She created the UI for where you can customize the warrior, right? It's not functional yet, but we drew inspiration from XCOM. We liked how in XCOM, how it was strategy, and yes, you can control, you can be there in first person shooting enemies, but you still felt like you were actually there. Like, it was a perfect blend of like the whole base building and managing your soldiers and then actually going out into the battlefield. Like, you don't have to be in the thick of stuff. Like, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be first person or third person in order to feel like you're actually there. XCOM, they do a great job of it, like I said, between managing and actual combat. So yes, we played the latest one, like XCOM, Enemy Unknown, XCOM 2, perfect examples. That was one of the inspirations. Like, XCOM Enemy Unknown was part of, like, back in college, when I seen that game, I was like, that's some kind of like something I want to do, but with hack and slash.
Yeah. And, like, speaking about XCOM and sort of like the evolution of the series, it's something that we really don't see too many games in the wide spectrum of things go with that approach of basically taking two completely different game systems and smacking them together. Like, the closest comparison would probably be something like the Total War series that goes, again, for the strategic layer, and then you have the real-time strategy combat. And it's always a challenge when you're essentially you're building two different games or two different completely game systems into one package.
Right. I think the reason why you don't really see that much of, well, there's games like Mass Effect 2, you know, remember when Mass Effect first came out, I was like, oh my god, it's the shooter RPG. And now, like, now Call of Duty's become an RPG, you know? Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons why people don't, like, with these AAA studios, it goes back to the whole cliche thing of, like, oh, will this concept sell, you know? Mm-hmm. Will it sell?
Yeah, and that is definitely a major topic we've talked about many times before, and how one of the things that we see from the independent space is the creating unique titles that you would never see from the AAA space. And then at some point, if it sells well enough, the AAA developers will come along and try to refine that into a AAA package worthy game.
That is true. I think a perfect example of that would be, was it Far Cry Primal? And then there was, but the indie version was like, I know people are going to get hella mad. They're going to get really mad and they're going to be like, man, you can't be comparing this, blah, 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 blah. I think, you remember when they were like, what year was it when they were like the year of the bow and arrow and all the other stuff, the survival building games? Do you remember that?
Yeah, like, it was like kind of like following Minecraft. Like, everyone wanted to be the next big open world survival game.
Exactly. Like, even though Minecraft's blown up, but I think that's a perfect example. Like, you will see how an indie would do something, and next you know, the AAA studios. Oh, another example, man. You remember that? You know that game Battalion 1944? Have you heard of that game?
No, but it may sound familiar. What was that one?
I'm not sure if it's actually out yet, but it's a, I call them an indie studio. They look like they're AAA. It's by Bulkhead Interactive. So they're creating a World War II shooter, right? They're going back to the original competitive shooters. Not like Doom, but like the original, like Call of Duties, right? Their Kickstarter was, I believe, in 2016, and their whole thing was they wanted to go back to the roots, you know? Like, they were talking about this whole new, like, you know, like Infinite Warfare and all this other stuff. They're returning back to World War II. Next thing you know, Battlefield came out with Battlefield 1. And I know people are going to be like, well, Trayvon, Battlefield 1 is World War I. But the whole thing is we're going back to the historical wars and stuff. And the thing about it with a AAA studio, they have more resources and assets. Therefore, they can see something, and yeah, they might have to deal with like the corporate red tape and stuff, but they can probably, with their resources, they can put something together very, very quickly. Whereas in an indie setting, they don't have to deal with that red tape stuff, so they can do stuff fast, but they might not have the resources.
Yeah.
So that's like another example of how an indie can do something, and the next thing you know, literally, it seems like overnight, the AAA just comes out with something.
Mm-hmm. And wrapping this back into XCOM, one thing that I'm really happy about is I've been seeing in news pieces, people are describing games as XCOM-like. Just like, as they said, like Dark Souls-like after that blew up. So if we see more XCOM-style games in the next few years, I will be a happy man for that.
That would be really, really cool. I think now that you brought it up, I don't know, maybe my team might get mad at me. Maybe we could start pitching our game like, hey, this is XCOM-like. But it's hack and slash, though. That's literally, XCOM had an influence on Bullock. Mm-hmm. So that can be something that we can add to our marketing line. I don't know. I'll have to discuss this with my team.
Or you could just say your game is Dark Souls. Like, even if it's not, that seems to be the popular describer for a lot of indie games these days. Just say it reminds you of Dark Souls, and that'll be good. or just add some skeletons to it.
You bring up another good point too. When it comes to marketing and branding, we actually discussed this like with the team. We're like, hey, we gotta be careful. Like, if we say this game is like God of War, right? People are gonna be, or like we try to compare with like some hardcore like beat 'em up or hack and slash, right? People are gonna come in thinking like, oh yeah, all these intricate combos and stuff, right? This combat system.
Oh, yes.
Like, no, Bullock is not meant to be like that. And we start telling people, this is a Dark Souls. Like, people are going to start expecting, like, a stamina meter and all this other stuff. Mm-hmm. These invincibility frames. Like, we don't have that. Like, we don't want people to start... When they start comparing it like that, and these YouTubers or people are playing it, it's going to be a failure.
Yes.
Because that's not... I guarantee you, you're not going to get Dark Souls from Bullock.
Mm-hmm. And you just had a really good point there, Charlie, again, about the perception of your game. Because as we've seen... Many indie games these days, as I just said, like Dark Souls-like or Souls-like has kind of become the new catch-all for a lot of action or challenging games. But just saying that your game is Souls-like or XCOM-like or anything like that doesn't mean anything if you don't understand what made those games work. Like, as you just said, with something like Dark Souls. When someone says Dark Souls to me, I immediately go to a very meticulous combat system with a stamina meter. So if you tell me your game is Souls-like and you don't have those two things, then I'm just going to call you a liar.
Exactly. And that's why we're not doing that. Like I said, Bullock is not that type of game. It's not for the hardcore combat people. Like, I feel like when it comes to gaming, I'm kind of average at it. I'm not really good at competitive gaming and stuff. Like, I die really easy in Battlefront. I mean, Battlefield and stuff. Sometimes I button mash. Like, Bullock is not meant for those people who are hardcore combat fanatics. Like, if you're looking for that hardcore, like, combos, like we said, invincibility frames and stamina meter and all this other stuff, yeah, and you should go play Dark Souls or Souls-like. Bullock is not that kind of... It's not the type of game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like for myself, I am horrible at competitive games. Like, I can play Left 4 Dead really well, but I fail at Overwatch and don't even ask if I ever got good at Call of Duty or Battlefield. Like, I just cannot play those kinds of games. And as we've seen, there are different markets for the different fan bases. And one of like the hardest things I think to do for a game design like this is trying to bridge the gap between the two. Can you make a game that will be great for someone who's never played an action game before, just as you can make a game that can also appeal to the expert-level players? And some designs and some genres, it works. And other times, I think it really comes down to just who exactly is your audience going to be, and then laser-focus in on that.
Right. There's different ways to approach it. Like, on one hand, you have these team meetings, you're discussing like, hey, this is what we want in the game, this is what the game's about. And then you got to look at the market and you're like, this is something the market's going to like. It's like a back and forth. And that's like the cool thing about social media. You can interact with people. And that's why I do these, I call these test fires. Like, that's why we release these demos. The whole point of these demos is just a test. It's a test to see how people react, where to improve. Good example would be last year when we did our first trailer. We got a good amount of views on Facebook. But from there, though, we learned how we can get more views on Facebook. And I'm not talking about with Facebook ads either. I'm talking about organically. Mm-hmm. Like, we learned. It's the whole point. We just keep testing and testing, iterating and improving upon that. If you can do that, that's how you win. So with this demo, we're going to be able to see like how people react to this new combo system, like how they feel about what we have in the game. And from there, with that feedback, we're going to implement it. So it works. Whatever works, we're going to double down on it. Mm-hmm. And if something doesn't work, look into it. But just because someone tells us, hey, this doesn't work, it doesn't mean that, hey, it doesn't work. Like, that's that person's opinion. So we're really going to look at it with scrutiny.
Yeah. I've been talking to a UI and playtester who works in playtesting and building his own board games, John Breiger, several times on our live cast for the last few months. And we talked about just how important it is when it comes to playtesting to be able to parse that data or understand what people are telling you. Just because someone says, I hate your game, or this sucks, there sometimes is a greater meaning in there. Like, why are they saying that? And one of the hallmarks, I think, of a great game designer is being able to understand just what are people telling me if they say they like so-and-so or they hate so-and-so.
That's a great way to put it. You have to be aware of the market, and have your own intuition about what's going on. So it's a combination of your knowledge and experience versus what you see from the market. You have to be able to do all of that. In the moment when you start, like, if you're just to yourself, like, you're building this game in a vacuum, you're probably going to lose.
Yes.
If you're just constantly listening to all this feedback and stuff, you're probably going to lose. Like, some people might tell me, they might say, like, hey, Trey, actually, no one's told me this yet. Well, hey, why do you have magic? The magic with the Mayish, it doesn't make any sense. Blood sacrifice, like the blood and stuff. I'm like, dude, it makes perfect sense. Their culture revolves around blood sacrifice. This makes perfect sense. So it all depends. So that's why you got to do a combination of being back and forth. And I remember we discussed this when I was talking about how it goes back to the game. One moment is strategy, and then the next minute is combat. You're the general, and then you're like the warrior. You got to have different mindsets when you're approaching game development.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and as you said, it all comes down to being able to basically wear all these different hats. You have to be the designer, but you also have to understand the marketing side. You also have to do community aspects. And it can become very hard to juggle all these plates while you're, of course, trying to build this game.
Right. And that's when also you got to realize like what your weaknesses are too. And you got to build your team. This is something I've been preaching for like the longest time. You can ask anybody, like I preach this, like, yo, if you're going to build a team, make sure you build it around the skills that you don't have. So if you're a good, I'll use me as an example, 3D artist, right? I can build environments, but I don't know how to program. That's why I have a programmer. I can okay animate. So that's why I get someone who's really, really good at animating. That's why we have Jeff. He's a really, really good animator. I can draw, but I'd rather not do that for the game. That's why we have a graphic designer who does UI. That's Stephanie right there. I can maybe model characters okay. But Theron has a better knowledge of anatomy, and he's better at ZBrush when it comes to organic modeling with characters. That's why he's on the team. Mm-hmm. So that's why I focus on what I'm really good at, and that's why I put people on the team who are good at stuff I'm not good at.
Mm-hmm. Definitely, and that is a really good approach. And we talked about this last time of if you know you can't do something, get someone who can do it for you. It's the same thing with marketing and PR. And like I'm not sure if we've had this conversation, but I've talked to a lot of people, and there's definitely a misconception, especially among like first time indie developers, that marketing is, you know, quote unquote evil. It's selling out and all that. And for a lot of first timers, they don't want to handle that aspect of the business. But if you can't handle it or you don't want to, then get someone who knows that and work with them.
Exactly. In my opinion, I feel like if you're the team leader, you should probably be, you know, you should be part of that voice of your product or whatever, right? But yeah, like go find someone, whether it's a PR firm. But you got to be careful though, because everybody claims to know how to do marketing.
Yeah.
You got to look at their results. I'm just going to put this out there, guys. Marketing, all it is, you're showing your product where the people are looking. That's why people were, that you know, like back then, people were listening to radios. People still listen to radios. That's why all advertisement was done on radios. That's why advertisement was done on billboards, because people look. Like, you're literally marketing where people are looking at. That's why we're all on social media now, so that's why you put your stuff on social media. But you're not just throwing stuff against the wall hoping it sticks. Like, you got to be smart about it, too. Mm-hmm. But if you embrace that concept of, hey, marketing is showing your product where the people are looking, then you'll be on a good start.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Now, speaking about marketing and such, I figure let's move on, or we'll transition to talking a little bit more about your plans for Kickstarter and kind of things that you've done, or at least what you've been starting to do in terms of preparing for it. So, again, since we last spoke, I know you had plans on doing the Kickstarter. I think when we first spoke, it was like February of 2016. Now, obviously, things have been delayed. So, for the folks listening to this cast, what are your current plans for a Kickstarter project for Bullock?
Gather around, children. I have a story. Yeah, originally, Josh, the Kickstarter. So last year, right, when I was on the Perspective podcast, right, I believe it was either in June or April or May of 2016. I was saying, hey, everyone, February 2017 is going to be the Kickstarter, right? But then as we got to October, after the trailer, and this goes back to the whole like testing and stuff, right, seeing how people react. After I released the trailer back in August of 2016, it made me realize that, hey, like, we might not be ready. And then it came around October, right, when we were showcasing the game at this thing called the Vampire Ball, right? It was, like, our first, like, event where we showcased the game. Just looking at how we were progressing versus where we wanted to be at and what the deadline was, I had a team meeting, and we just realized, hey, like, we're not ready yet for Kickstarter. So we postponed it by like another year. And like, we literally postponed it by another year. That was the question. And they all, what's that word? Unanimously or whatever they call it, agree with me. Like, hey, yeah, we need more time. Mm-hmm. So you got to recognize where you're at, where you're trying to be at, what the deadline is, and can you do it? Mm-hmm. That's why we postponed it. We needed the campaign map, better graphics, better combat.
Yeah, and this is definitely a very major part, especially in today's market. As we've talked about before, and for fans of Game Wisdom, you know, we've had this conversation in the past, but the Kickstarter of today is completely different from the Kickstarter of 2012, 2013. And one of the things I think a lot of new developers may run into is rushing on the Kickstarter when the project is not ready for it. Or you could have the project that's ready, but maybe your actual Kickstarter campaign isn't the best way of selling at the moment. You have to go back and do that.
Right. Josh, man, we can discuss this all day. In regards to being prepared for Kickstarter, like I know I got all these rules and ground rules and all this other stuff. I should get like a poster, like a shirt saying like Trayvon's rules of like product development or marketing. Like, first rule, man, you don't sell or do Kickstarter. You don't go for money. You don't ask for the money for something when you don't even have the audience. And that's like the problem people were doing. Like, they first seen these Kickstarters, right? What's that guy's name? Man, people are going to be mad at me. Double Fine. Yeah. Remember Double? When they put that, I think that's what made Kickstarter blow up. When that dude put his project on there, I don't even remember the name of the game. Like, people are going to be mad at me. I just know it in the comments.
I'll try and save you. I think you're referring to Broken Age.
Yeah, I think so. Because of who he was, like, yeah, he was able to gain that following really quickly on Kickstarter. So people started getting this idea of like, hey, man, if we just go to Kickstarter, it's just going to blow up. And we discussed it before, Josh. It's not like that. It's not like, hey, I can just put this there and then it's going to happen. Like, no, you have to do the groundwork to build up your fan base. Yeah. Especially now, since everyone's going to Kickstarter, like, you can't just go there. You need you need to build your following, build your fan base. You need to build your product as well. It's still possible to have a really good product and maybe your Kickstarter fails. It's like with movies and stuff or certain games. Like, hey, there wasn't enough coverage. And that goes back to contacting the right people who can help you spread your message. Going to those right people, doing the press releases, the press contacts, being in the Facebook groups, all kinds of stuff. I should create like a diagram or something.
Yeah. And even then, there's also the work that goes into the Kickstarter itself. You need to plan, what am I going to offer to people? What are my stretch goals? Am I going to have stretch goals? What kind of video are we going to show? How long is our Kickstarter going to be? I spoke with Ed Healy he does publishing for board games at his company Gamerati, and we basically had a good 40-50 minute chat about basically what he does for each one of the Kickstarters and all the planning and preparations that go into the Kickstarter. And this doesn't even include, the actual design of the board game. This is just, how are we going to pitch this to people to convince them to give us money?
Right. I look at it, I created a thing called, the document is called Bullock Roadmap. It puts everything such as what we need done before the Kickstarter, what can we do to increase the fan base? Mm-hmm. One of them, or like just different aspects of the fan base or different aspects of the Kickstarter. Like, one of them is something I keep overlooking is our backer rewards. So that's something we're going to have a meeting about very soon. Mm-hmm. Backer rewards. I've created the script for our trailer. Like, we know what we're going to do for the trailer. We know what's going to happen for the pitch. Like, we have those ironed out. But I think the main concern is backer rewards, because I don't want to just overlook that, Mm-hmm. So that's something we'll need to look into more. So you got to know what your backer rewards are, how you're going to let people know. Oh, one of our plans is this. Like, I guess I'll announce it now. I guess this is an unofficial announcement. So one of the things people are doing is going to the Square Enix Collective. Have you heard of that, Josh?
Yes, I've spoken with, I think, Kid Fox Games a few times. I know they've been a part of that.
Right. The Square Enix Collective is just, it's all part of the marketing plan, dude. The Square Enix Collective, they're trying to represent indies and stuff, right, before they go to Kickstarter. So they're using their Square Enix, right? The Final Fantasy guys, they're using their platform, and Kingdom Hearts 2, they're using their platform to build awareness around your indie game before you go to Kickstarter. That's one of the things we're doing. We're going there in January. We're going to submit in like December. Mm-hmm. The other thing too is the whole press contact list, contacting the people who work on like Game Informer, YouTubers, That's where people are looking at. People are looking at these YouTubers. People are looking, even being on podcasts, Josh. Mm-hmm. Podcasts like me. People are listening to this. It's like why people go on the radio shows. It's just standard stuff that we are doing, but we got to do it on a bigger scale now. Like, that's how we're going to build awareness on the Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm. And again, like, it's not, like, being, again, like, that big misconception for a lot of first-time developers is that this kind of PR work is one and done. You know, I go on a podcast or I send my video to a YouTuber and then I don't have to do any more marketing anymore. No, it's not like that. It becomes a consistent part of your day-to-day life. Or if you have a PR firm or a PR person, it becomes a part of their daily life.
Right. One of the things, one of our strategies, I know my brother, he's going to get mad at me. I delegated him as the, when it comes time for the Kickstarter for that month, he's going to be managed. He's going to be watching over it since he has the most time. He'll be watching over it and interacting because he's actually helped one of my friends out on his film, right? He's actually helped him. I believe I contacted you about the film too. He's helped him get nearly 50,000 views on his trailer and stuff. Like, he was in the group. He took what I did, and he just took it to the next level. He's in the Facebook groups. So, like, if you don't have time, like, designate someone for that month where they can oversee this thing. I feel like I've gotten away from your original question. Your question was about, the PR thing, too. Post on social media regularly, whether it's Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, or Instagram. Because all you're doing when you're posting content, it contributes to your image. So it puts that in people's mind, like, hey, this person is doing this. I'll give you a prime. I'll use me as an example. I post on my Instagram that I'm working on the game. So now people see me when I go to the grocery store or something, like, hey, you're working on that game. Like, yeah. Or like, even I'm a car salesman too. So people would be like, hey, you're selling the car, man. Can I stop by one day, you know, to look at this car? By you, Josh, you post about your podcast, your website. People know you as the guy who does speeches on game design, who run, like, Josh, he has his own podcast. Oh my God. Mm-hmm. Why? Because you're posting on social media. It goes back to your image and how people perceive you. Mm-hmm. So you have to, as a developer, have somebody be on the social media to represent you, whether it's you or someone else.
Yep, definitely. And like I think we said the first time we spoke, like, you found me, I think, through Twitter, because I started doing more posting on Twitter and being more active on there.
Right, exactly, through Twitter. I remember, too, I was like, hey, when we first started, I was like, okay, we need to get the word out. What can we do here? So there was Facebook. We didn't have content for YouTube, right? And then there was Instagram. Like, a lot of my fan base came from Instagram as well, right? I'll put everyone on game real quick in regards to Instagram, but that's later, though. So, yeah, I was like, we need to be on podcasts and magazines, even though we're early on. So now it's like, hey guys, we exist. So yeah, I went to Twitter. I was like, anybody here doing write articles or podcasts? And then we got in contact through a mutual associate. I don't even remember who the person was, Josh. But that's how we met. That's how we met. And then it goes back to it. Like, Twitter is a great way to get the word out too. You got to pick your platform. And I believe yours is like Twitter and YouTube. Mm-hmm. Like, I think you're hardcore about Twitter, right? Yeah, you got to find your platform. And that's how you get the word out. And that's how we met.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's just stuff you have to add to your daily routine if you want to try and make it. Because one of the biggest challenges of this industry is the fact that everyone is trying to do the same thing as you. They may not be making the same exact game, but they are trying to get their game in front of the eyes of people just as you are. And there's only so many hours in the day and so many people to buy your game. And one of the things that I've heard a lot of horror stories from is, you know, the fear of, I put my game on Steam, and in 24 hours, it's not even mentioned on the front page anymore. And it can be very scary for developers to realize that I didn't do any marketing, so no one knows about my game.
Yeah, that's very scary. I don't care who you are. Like, I wouldn't wish that upon anybody. That's like showing up to an event, like you're a comedian, and you show up, and there's nobody there. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't want that. So that's why some people ask me, like, hey, when's the game going to be ready? And they keep asking me, and I tell them, like, it's going to be ready this year. But that doesn't matter, though, because if I don't have the fan base, you're not going to see anything. Like, that's one criteria. Like, if we don't have a fan base, we're not releasing.
Yeah.
And go back to the Kickstarter, and that's why I talked to the team, like, hey, we should, like, last year in October, hey, instead of doing the Kickstarter in February 2017, let's wait till February 2018. We were talking about 2018, even though it was 2016, yeah. Because not only did it give us time to develop our product further, but it gave us time to build a bigger fan base. Mm-hmm. It's like you said, Josh, you don't want to drop something on Steam and then nobody's talking about mm-hmm. it. There's no, that would be the worst feeling ever. So there's things you can do to avoid that.
Yeah. And like I guess like from my own experience, when I did my first actual live presentation, when I was at a library for, it was last year for their Comic-Con, for like the first like 15 minutes of me like setting up, like there was no one in the room. Like, oh my God, am I just going to be like here by myself for the next hour? Like, oh God, please have people show up. Please have people show up.
Right. It goes back to preparation mm-hmm. and building. So you'll hear like a lot of people who are like really good at marketing. They'll tell you, you need at least 6 months before your release, minimum 6 months of marketing. Like I've seen this one game about survival. They had a Kickstarter. Their Kickstarter was about to roll out in the next like month. And I'm looking, I'm like, they just got on Kickstarter. Like they just got on Facebook 3 months ago. How'd they build their fan base? And what they did, they sent out press releases yeah. and stuff. If your product is really, really good, that press release to contacts, magazines, podcasts, websites and blogs, that can go along like very far. Mm-hmm. So make sure you have the product there. That way, when you're showcasing it, right, it's just like back to my car, like me doing car sales. Like me, so I just gotta sell now.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And like I'll give you another example. Like, I spoke to a developer, which by the time I hope by the time folks are listening to this podcast, this actual cast I did with him will go up. But the plan was to basically post the podcast the week of the Kickstarter. But unfortunately, while they were doing last-minute preparations, they realized that the Kickstarter wasn't up to what they wanted to be. So they pushed back their whole Kickstarter to make sure that that works rather than rush the Kickstarter and potentially, you know, mess up on that front.
I think I know what you mean. You mean maybe in the first 3 days they're like, we don't have... Like, we're not at where we want to be at in the first 3 days. Therefore, we should cancel the Kickstarter and reschedule. Is that what you mean?
No, they were basically looking at what they had on the Kickstarter in terms of what they were showing and what they were offering. They thought, maybe we could make this better. Maybe we could make this more appealing to people. And so they decided to push it back. But I think when we last spoke, it was like about a month, just to redo or refinalize the Kickstarter plans.
They're smart. That's a smart thing to do. You're reassessing what you have before you're doing your launch. It's kind of like people get mad that these movies and these games get pushed back. There's a reason why. Mm-hmm. Whether they were overreaching with their budget and stuff, or they feel like it wasn't ready. Well, I can't really speak on behalf of them, but for me, this is why we waited. We pushed it back by another year, which was a very, very smart decision. The game is completely different from what it was last September. Mm-hmm. It's like a singularity or something. And the people you spoke with, they were smart. They seen that the Kickstarter wasn't ready. Like they assessed what they had and they realized it wasn't ready. We're going to wait.
Yep.
Have they launched yet on Kickstarter or no?
No, not as of our recording. Hopefully, again, for the time this podcast goes up and the folks are listening to it, the Kickstarter will go up.
Right. Well, they're smart. I'm going to put it like that. Mm-hmm. Like, I think they're smart.
Yeah.
For doing that. So who are they?
I don't want to name it right at the moment.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I totally understand, but that was very smart. If you reassess, like especially like as a team leader, you got to look around and see what you have. Like if you're a leader, dude, you're like the captain of the ship. You need to know, like, hey, like this thing is broken, man. We can't roll with this because your team is counting on you. Mm. So I know I keep saying this, but that person, whoever it was, and that he or she and their team, very smart for pushing back their Kickstarter to make sure that it was adequate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because go ahead.
Doing tests and stuff, like you're literally like a Kickstarter is different from just from like doing like a test demo or something. Like that's some serious stuff. Like you need to be ready.
Mm-hmm. And as you were saying a few minutes ago, Tron, with releasing your game as well, you only have one solid chance to do it. And it goes back to that famous, I think, Shigeru Miyamoto quote that a delayed game can eventually be good, while a rush game is always bad. Or I may have paraphrased it a little bit.
Right. Like people are going to be mad at me. That What was his name again?
What
was his name
Shigeru
again?
Shigeru Miyamoto.
Is that the guy from Metal Gear Solid?
Oh, no, that's Mario. Oh, I don't think I can save you from that one, Trayvon, I think.
No, you can't. Hey, you know what? It, people will know. They're going to be like, yeah, that's that guy who didn't. Yeah, people are going to be mad. Bring it on. But what he said, though, was very smart. I can just imagine right now, just people are just like facepalming. But no, it's true. Like, you don't want to rush the product. If you rush the product, and it's not, it's like a missile launch or something, like a test launch. Like, if you're launching, if you're going to launch something, dude, you better make sure, like, if you're flying something, if that thing isn't ready, you're in big trouble. If for him to say that, it makes perfect sense. Make sure that the product is ready. Make sure the fan base is ready. Don't just rush. And that's why you don't want to put yourself in situations where you're forced to acquire money. Like, if you're in that situation, then it can really mess it up. You want to put yourself in a position where your team can make smart moves. You're not making rushed moves, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep. And again, like, we've seen so many examples of games that just weren't ready to be released, but had to meet a, you know, the shipping date or a production date. And it can eventually screw you, such as recent with Mass Effect Andromeda. And they kind of
God.
Oh, yeah, I know.
We don't talk about that. No, just kidding. Yeah, Josh, Mass Effect Andromeda, like, when I played it, I didn't notice anything. Like, I didn't really notice anything wrong with it, like, the initial release. I think I bought it when it first came out. It seemed normal to me, but I kept hearing what people were saying about it. I was like, oh, that makes sense now.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so much that goes on, and I think this is a really important point, probably one way too big to get into for our cast today, but there is a very huge, I think, misconception about what exactly goes on behind the scenes with a video game versus what the actual product is when the consumer, you know, buys it on Steam or picks it up at a store and so on.
Yeah, I just did a tweet the other day on Twitter. Like, I got back on Twitter, and one of the funniest things was it Twitter or Facebook? Like, I think I put out both. On both, like, in game development, it's so crazy. Like, a solution can be achieved by adjusting a variable by like 0.5. Mm-hmm. So that means if you have like a setting, right? I'll give you an example. Okay, let's say like you have a setting that controls the color of something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're just like, that red isn't gonna work. That red isn't gonna work, but it needs to be red. And you adjust it by 0.5. You're like, oh, that's perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But this is through like hours of iterations, man.
Oh,
of
yeah.
Red.
Yes.
Like, that's the perfect example. Like, you're going back and you're like, what's wrong with my code? But yeah, there can be a disconnect sometimes between what the people see on the outside versus the people who are working on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can hear it, like, maybe, like, with Andromeda is a perfect example, like you said.
Mm-hmm.
We got this game and we're just like, yo, what happened? And then you look about what was going on during the course of it, like the different teams, the development, the problems that were occurring. Like, there's a lot of stuff that can happen behind the scenes that can affect. It's like with Star Wars. They keep on, like, I don't know if you heard, but was it, what's his name? The guy for episode 9, they just got rid of him.
Yeah, I just heard about that, I think, on the news the other day.
Yeah, it's like with the Han Solo director, too. They got rid of him because they're like, yeah, creative differences and stuff. That's some behind-the-scenes stuff. Like, maybe by doing that, maybe the new Star Wars movies, they'll be in sync with the Disney, like, just with their story group, what they want, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but... And that, like I was just saying, like, for a lot of consumers, either they don't hear that news or they don't understand it when it comes out. All they see is basically, this is the game, you know, why am I not enjoying it? Or why isn't this as up to par as your other titles? And it can be very hard, as you just said, Trayvon, to show the work when it comes to designing a game. Like, I'll give you an example. With XCOM 2, the expansion, War of the Chosen, there are a lot of changes to the underlying systems of the game in terms of UI differences, how certain things react, new options. But outside of telling someone, oh, there's a brand new alien or there's a brand new gun, it's very hard to tell someone what's different at the engine level versus, you know, something on the surface level, like saying, oh, your game has 5 new levels, or we've added in 3 new endings, or stuff like that.
Right. Yeah, disconnect between development and consumer sometimes. Like, adding that one extra level can be the difference between, like, 24 hours. Like, with Bullock, I'll be transparent, since we're not like a AAA corporation, I'm not going to get in trouble for saying this, but
mm-hmm.
Yeah, if we would have cut out, like, the reason why the demo got delayed by 2 days, we were supposed to release back on Tuesday. And I was doing some enemy balancing, making sure the enemies reacted appropriately, like with the difficulty and stuff. I was thinking to myself, like, hey, is this too difficult? Okay, it's too easy now. Making sure that the enemies were a perfect balance. And then making sure a level loaded up correctly. That literally would delay me for like the past maybe 12 hours, making sure the level loaded correctly. Every time I would build it out, the level wouldn't load correctly. Like I said before, I can say that because we are an indie studio. No one's going to be like, oh, no one's going to come at me with some legal stuff like saying, you weren't supposed to say that. Whereas if I was working for like a corporation, I can, like, if I was the environment artist, I can say like, hey, we got delayed because, you know, this, mm-hmm. I guess this level wouldn't load up. Like, that's the cool thing about being an indie. You can be more transparent about stuff.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And
you remember that farm simulator? No, was it Ant Farm? Yeah, you remember that game, Ant Farm Simulator or whatever?
No, I don't.
Okay, let me bring you guys up to speed. Last year, right? Was it last year or the year before? So this guy, right? He does tutorials and stuff. He was working on a game called Ant Farm. Yeah, it's like, or I don't know if it's Ant Farm, whatever it's called. You're playing as an ant. It's an ant simulator mm-hmm. game, right? Everything was cool, and then like some stuff happened where they couldn't make release the game anymore. And then he told everyone, like, this is what happened. My team went and did, the people who I was working with, they went and did this with the money and all this stuff. You didn't hear about that?
I may have heard something, but the name's not coming to me.
Yeah, I feel like I'm not using the right name. Like, as an indie, I feel like, as an indie, he was able to tell people that, you know? And there's probably two sides to the story. Whereas as a corporation, they can't come out and say that. They have to use some stuff like, either they could say there was some embezzlement, or they probably can't even talk about that because they're a big corporation. So the cool thing about being indie, you can be transparent, more transparent about stuff.
Mm-hmm. And that level of transparency has been a major boon when it comes to interact with your community. Because as I'm sure you're no doubt aware of, as we talk about with the social media side, it can be amazing for a consumer to go on a Steam forum or a Facebook group or even just the developer's own forum and actually talk to the people who are making the game.
Right. That's why the Discord thing we were talking about earlier, it sounds really, really cool because it's a live discussion versus like if you're on the forums are cool. Twitch is cool, right? Mm-hmm. But the Discord thing you're telling me about, that's really cool because it's like live discussion. But I'm not going to underestimate the forums as well. The forums and social media, it allows people to interact with the developers, get their feedback. You'll see on some products and games, like they'll actually respond to the person, which is something I don't take for granted. I respond to every comment. Well, hold on. Let me retract that statement. If someone says something, if someone asks me a question or they say like it looks really cool, I address them. Now, if it's just some dumb troll, I'm just going to ignore them. Some people might be like, don't ignore the trolls. Me, I ignore the trolls. So the one thing about a troll, you just got to make them feel irrelevant. And how you make them feel irrelevant, you just don't acknowledge them. You let the rest handle it. You let nature handle it.
Mm-hmm. And again, that's probably another good 40-50 minute discussion we could have about PR and handling people on your forums.
Right.
Now, I guess here's a question that I wanted to ask you about, Terrell, especially as we've talked about with the with your plan, of course, of delaying the Kickstarter by a year and, you know, working on more and iterating on it. I guess I'm sure that you've done research on your own about what Kickstarters were popular or what things to follow. So I guess in your opinion, with the work that you've done or as you're preparing the Kickstarter, are there any major, I guess, do's and don'ts that you could think of, like, for someone listening to this cast who may be working on their first Kickstarter going forward?
I'm more than happy to go over that. Like I said before, Josh, I need, like, a calendar, a shirt, or a poster. Me on it saying, like, Trayvon's rules. I just want to clear something up real quick. Like, yeah, the Kickstarter is going to be February 2018. Mm-hmm. So, like, with the delay was from last year. So, this February coming up is when we do the Kickstarter. Rule number one, like, make sure you have your fan base. Give yourself a minimum. Me, I prefer, you know, two years minimum. But if your product is really, really there, then 6 month minimum before you start going for the money. That's a must. You got to build the fan base, which I feel like I can't say it's common sense, but I'm just surprised there's a lot of people talking about it, but there's other people, they'll do a Kickstarter or they'll do like a release and then they're like, why didn't this work? And I'm just looking at the internet, and I'm like, because your fan base wasn't there. I've been saying this like since day one. That's one thing. Rule number two, make sure your product is there. It's why we delayed the game, like, besides our fan base, like, wanted to develop. We need to make sure the product was there before we started going. Like, anytime you go for money, you owe it to your fans that your product is there when you go for the money. This is why people are fed up with, like, some AAA studios. They release the game, and the game's not all that there, and they got to pay for DLC. I'll let everyone else fill in the blanks and put the names to the game and stuff, you know. Like, you owe it to your fans. When you go for the money, you owe it to them to have the product there. That's pretty much the, I guess, when it comes to Kickstarter and doing your research too, and don't go off of survivorship bias, which I'm kind of guilty of, you know, just looking at like the survival, like the people. Well, actually, I look at a lot of people who failed with the Kickstarters too, but like, don't overemphasize the people who did really good on the Kickstarter. One of the things you can do is reach out to people. That's literally what I did last year when I first started out. I started reaching out to people. Like, certain, you know the game Jotun?
I'm sorry?
You know the game Jotun?
Is that Jotun?
Jotun? Yeah, the Norse mythology. I could be missing. I reached out to the developer. I said, hey, I seen your Kickstarter. Like, can you give me some tips? And he told me, like, in regards to press contacts and stuff, like, how many, and I asked him questions, like, how many people did you contact? He gave me references and stuff, like, he told me, like, oh, yeah, he contacted this many amount of people. He gave me some tips. I contacted the people from Battalion 1944. I asked them, like, what did you do? They got back to me with one simple email, and it was this: make sure your product is there. And when I first started out, I was like, that's not what I want to hear. I'm like, I want to know the exact, like, the tactics. Like, you know, like, what exactly are you doing? But as I got further along with Bullock, I realized, like, yeah, like, what they said is true. Your product. Make sure your product is there as well. That's like one of the best things you can do. Make sure your product is there. So don't be afraid to ask people who succeeded, and make sure to pay attention to the people who didn't succeed, and look at where they messed up at. Mm-hmm. I guess that's the best feedback. That's the best advice I can give. Yeah.
And like, here's an example like that I've seen from another developer who kind of messed up on the not having the market or not having done the social media side of things. I was on a Facebook group. Someone was posting about this game, and they're like, I don't know why no one's buying it. Like, can you give me any help? And so I Googled them. They didn't have any website set up. Their YouTube channel had maybe like 20 subscribers. All their videos on the game maybe had less than 100 views. And it was just like, there's nothing there to this game. Like, there's nothing here telling me why I should play this video game. And that's one of the most essential parts when it comes to marketing. And especially for Kickstarter, you have to tell people or explain to them, hey, I have this game, it's really cool, you should donate money so I can make it. But if you can't do that, or if you're not able to properly sell that game or sell yourself, it's just going to end in failure, I think.
This goes back to when you said, we can have 3-hour discussions about that. It goes back to, you're creating that unique puzzle game or something, that game, that unique mechanic, but the market, there's probably not enough people in the world who want that. So you got to have an idea of, like, what you want to do, your originality, versus, like, what the market wants. Mm-hmm. Just being aware. And then I think a lot of people, too, like, people, they're probably doing stuff the right way. They're just not doing it on a big enough scale. I'll give you an example. Like, if you're contacting, like, 50 to 100 people for your press list, like, for your press release, it's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And this is just from, like, me looking at what games, asking people who succeeded, and it's asking people whose Kickstarter failed and stuff. And I'm looking, and I'm asking them, and I'm taking in what they told me, and the numbers, man, the numbers, they start adding up. I'm like, okay, that's why. So you got to do stuff on a bigger scale, too, and figure out how to do things on a bigger scale, reach out to the appropriate amount of people. The other thing, too, I like to do, I like to go into the news section on Google, and if I see, like, a lot of stuff about it, then I'm like, oh, yeah, this is about this right here. Oh, my God, this is the thing. If there's nothing in the news about it on the news section of Google, I'm like, oh, God, this is not going to work. You can even go to YouTube, too. You just got, and it goes back to him, the developer, preparing, giving himself enough time. Like, a lot of people, they're not putting themselves in a position where they can make smart moves. Like, they need the money, so they're going to start doing stuff, rushing stuff, which is bad.
Yeah. And, again, like, another really good case in point, when a developer posts their game up, but there are no press contacts whatsoever to get in touch with them. And I have seen this more times than I really should when I see a cool game on Steam or a friend says, hey, Josh, you gotta check this game out, get in touch with them. I go, sure. I type their game in on Google, nothing comes up. I type in the name of the developer on Google, nothing comes up. And it's like, where the hell are these people? Like, I shouldn't have to playing hide and seek to get in touch with you.
Right. Hide and seek is a good way to put it. It's staying relevant, too. I'm going to be honest. Our website is down right now. But if you Google Bullock or you Google my name, the Instagram comes up. The Facebook comes up. I mean, like, my personal Instagram with all the Bullock stuff on it. Like, there has to be a way for people to contact you. That search engine optimization, that SEO. You got to find ways, whether it's the website. People need to be able to, like you said, they need to be able to Google you or your product and need to find a way to contact you. Maybe your email is nothing. Fine. They should be able to DM you on Twitter or Instagram or Facebook. There needs to be some way. But if you don't have that stuff, then you're setting yourself up to fail.
Mm-hmm. And again, like as you said, like this is stuff that if you were preparing, you know, 3 to 6 months out of the way or beforehand, you should have taken care of this or at least taken the steps to do this. But if you just, you can't, oh yeah, this is another thing that I hear, or I've heard from some people who've done marketing before. You don't start marketing your game one day before it comes out, or 1 month before it comes out. You have to do this, again, you have to have the proper preparation beforehand.
Right, you know what, I'm going to make a poster. I'm going to make a poster. You're absolutely right, like, do not do that. I think the problem is too, people, they'll look at like these mainstream people and they'll do that. And they're like, well, if this person did that, I'll give an example. Like Beyonce, she had an album or something. Like she just released it out of nowhere. She didn't tell anybody at first. And then out of nowhere, just like picked up speed. That's because Beyonce. It goes to the people from Double Fine. They just dropped it on Kickstarter. Yeah, it was early Kickstarter, but they already had a following. So things just picked up, you know, but for average people, well, we're not average, but if you're not up there, if you're not mainstream, don't do stuff like that.
Yeah.
Even then, though, you have movies and stuff like people that you didn't hear about until like the last minute, and they probably did bad. Whereas you have like J.J. Abrams, Clover Lane or Cloverfield Lane or whatever. I didn't hear about that until like me personally, I didn't hear about it until like 2 days before I seen the movie. I guess people didn't hear about it until like maybe like 3 months before. Like he was able to do it. He was smart about it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do it.
Yeah.
Be smart.
Yeah, you have to be able to understand the difference between having the clout already versus doing the work. Like, I am sure that if, Beyonce, J.J. Abrams, and everyone else, like, for their very first big hit, I'm sure they worked their butts off doing all the necessary PR. And this goes back to what we were saying before, the disconnect between the consumer and the game development. A lot of people, even other indie developers, they'll see a game like Stardew Valley or Five Nights at Freddy's or Undertale and think, well, this game just appeared one day and made millions of dollars, so I can do the same thing. But there was a lot of work going on behind the scenes. You know, as you said, you know, emailing the proper people in press, getting in touch with YouTubers, trying to build a community that all led to the success. Like, I can't think of any game that I've played in the last decade that just magically appeared and, you know, sold 10 million copies or was a bestseller without doing any other work.
Right. And if they did, like I said, don't do that.
Yeah.
That's all I can say. Like, don't do, it's like, I don't recommend you playing, Russian Roulette? Yeah. Don't play Russian Roulette. No. Don't do that. Don't do that. That's all I can say. Do not. Do that. Make sure you market in advance, guys. You give yourself 6 months in advance to build that fan base and make sure your product. Now, if the product is there, like this product is legit, then you may have some wiggle room, you know, like when you do that 6 months out type of stuff. But other than that, it's kind of like why people ask me, like, hey, when are you guys releasing Bullock? 2019. Like, Bullock is going to be released in 2019. People are like, 2019? Oh my God. And you know, it's 2017. So just imagine how people were reacting when they would ask me in person back in 2016. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, gives us enough time to build the product and to build the fan base.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, man. Like, that's like 3 years. You want to give yourself enough time.
Yeah. And as you said, there's always that challenge of knowing or being able to just understand, like, what do I have with my game? Like, how long do I really need to work on this? because we've seen cases where developers have super rushed out a project. You know, they spend maybe 5 to 6 months on this game and they expect it to sell, you know, 10 million copies. But then we've seen things on the other end of the scale where games go into very long-term game development. I'm talking 5+ years. And it becomes a lot harder to make back that money. But again, part of that challenge is the fact that every game development is different. Every studio, every group of designers works differently than everyone else. So, you know, what works, and I think this goes back to what you were just saying, Trayvon, with, you know, just because some big name studio or some big name person did something doesn't automatically mean it's going to work for you. Like, a very big case in point will, of course, be Valve. Valve at this point has earned, you know, more money than we will ever see in our lives. But that doesn't necessarily mean that if I just copy everything Valve's done, I'm going to be a bajillionaire.
Right. I'm not Nostradamus. I don't have all the answers. I can only speak on what I observe in my experience. But yeah, you can't do what the big time people do. You have to be aware of, it goes back to, like, you got to be aware of what you have, what your team has. Listening to their input, looking at the market, you're being able to take feedback from all kinds of streams, I guess. That's why this Saturday, like, I'm having a meeting with two of my teammates to go over the Kickstarter and where we're at with the game. And after that, we have another meeting with everybody, with everyone on our team, to see, to just assess where we're at and if we're ready and stuff. It's just you got to assess where you're at. Like, yeah, you're constantly moving, and then you're assessing what's going on. Yeah. You're, like, adapting to what's unfolding in front of you.
Yeah, and that's why project management is such a very important skill set to have, especially if you're an indie developer. Again, for a lot of people, especially those coming from the AAA side of things, when you're on your own like this, you don't have a publisher telling you what you should be doing. You don't have people saying, you need to get this game done by so-and-so. You have complete freedom to do whatever you want, whenever you want. But if you can't manage, you know, 4 or 5 people, or, you know, for, like, bigger size studios, you know, 20, 30 plus, you know, nothing's ever going to get done that will matter, essentially.
Right. You open yourself up to all this chaos. The problem is, I remember we discussed this too last time. You have people coming in from AAA studios. They're starting up their indie studio. They go to Kickstarter and it fails for whatever reason, right? It's kind of like with people, and you hear this a lot, someone will get a cool idea for a game, right? Like a bunch of maybe students or so, right? Or maybe people from within the industry. They're like, oh my God, this game's going to be awesome. They have this meeting and they invite like 50 people to the meeting, right? Like this like gathering. There's like, hey guys, we got this game here. Everyone's excited and stuff. But what happens is not like you might have like 100 people, but not everyone's going to do their part. So that's why what I did was what I realized back in college. If you're doing stuff like this, man, you have to start off small. So do your part first, and you slowly by slowly start adding people on. It makes it easier to manage. You have something that's already run. You have infrastructure that's already moving. I feel like maybe infrastructure and moving probably shouldn't go in the same sentence. But you get my point, though. You're able to add on people. It makes it easier to manage. You don't make it a 50-person free-for-all. No, like, you have some structure to it. You have stuff already moving in place before you add people on. And that's where a lot of these studios fail, too. They don't have the right infrastructure. They just keep expanding, and that's how they go out of business, too.
Yeah.
You gotta be...
Yeah, like, well, that's... Oh, my goodness. That's another 2-hour-long discussion right there. Like, we've seen developers who basically, you know, double down and go big on their next project. And, you know, they'll take like an 8 to 10 man studio and say, you know what, we're going to add 30, 40 more people to this game idea. And we're going to throw, you know, an extra $1 million or $2 and it will be, you know, 5 times better than our last game. Like, what's your game idea? We don't know yet. We're just going to grow first and we're going to, you know, go big with this next idea. But if you keep adding chaos to your project like that, it becomes harder to make something concrete and that, you know, it feels like everything is working together like that.
Right. Someone said more money, more problems or something. I don't know if it was from like a rap lyric or something, right? And it reminds me of like when I'm playing these strategy games, more empire, more cities, more problems. Like the more you have, the more it is to manage. You have to be aware of what you have and what you're able to do. And you have to be able to assess the skills on your team. And that's paying attention to what's going on around you. So, yeah, it is a bad idea. Like, you can make a game and then it can make millions. And then next thing you know, people like you're like, we're going to massive expansion and stuff, right? That's bad. You don't want to just massively expand because you have all this money. You have to like be smart about how you expand. And that's why I always tell myself, I tell some of my team too, like, man, honestly, even after bullet releases and stuff, I don't want to manage no more than 20 people on the production team. No more than 20 people. Ideally, I would say 8 to 12 people, but no more than 20 people. Like, I'm not doing the whole 100, 200 people. Like, no, I'm not doing that. Like, And some people might look at me like, but man, that's more opportunity. I'm like, no, you're crazy. Like, no. That's called knowing yourself and knowing the people you're with and understanding what's going on. Yeah.
And again, it goes back to what you were saying earlier, that disconnect between development and the consumer. That, and even just with developers themselves, they think that, oh, if I thought my game could work with $1 million and we hit, you know, $3 million, well, that means my game will automatically be three times better than it was before. But it doesn't work like that. And it's very hard to, again, put a price tag on what it means to design a video game.
Right. I remember you had I said this before too. It was one of my favorite interviews you did, but it was like last year. It was, I don't remember her name. She was from M Plus.
Mayor Shepherd, I think, or not.
Yeah, she said it perfectly. Like, people can't tell you how much to sell your game for. Like, you can't, like, a customer can't tell you that. And then she said, I believe she said, no matter what, like, you can tell them that no matter what, someone's going to always be like, it's too much, so why not put it for what you believe it should be worth? Mm-hmm. So that's why when it comes to, like, this pricing and stuff, don't really listen to the customers, because the customer is going to be like, oh, yeah, this, and this. And then no matter what, they're always going to be like, oh, this is too high. So you, as team leader and team whatever, you decide how much do you think your effort is worth. I think that's what she said too. Like, it's you're determining, you can decide how much your effort is worth, not the customers. Now, at that point, now this is my part where I say, now you owe it now to your fans and customers to back up your pricing with the product. Yes.
And that.
So if the.
Oh, go ahead, finish your thing.
I was saying, and let's use common sense here. The game's only an hour or 2 hours long. Don't be charging people $60. No. Like, don't do that.
Yep, and that's what I was saying about. Of course, by the time you folks are listening, it will probably be a few weeks. But what happened in August? Did you hear about the indie developer of We Happy Few?
No. Well, that's the thing about me. Sometimes, like, I can be aware of stuff, and then other times I just double down on what I'm doing. And then I end up not hearing about stuff until afterwards. Josh, tell me, what happened?
Well, We Happy Few was it was going to be a story-based game with an open world, like sort of like a secondary mode to it. It takes place in like an alternate history of London where everyone's basically, it's like kind of like that retro future tech kind of place. And the game went on Kickstarter. It succeeded. I think it made like $250,000 or something like that for the Kickstarter. They went on to early access with Steam. And the game's been in development, I think it's been on early access for a year, maybe 2 years now. And so what they announced in August was that they're going to raise the price of the game up from $30 to $60, and they've received a publisher contract with Gearbox to complete the rest of the game by April of 2018. And a lot of people are upset with them, saying, you know, what is this going to, why is this game doubling in price, and, you know, what's going on there? And
I know why.
Yep.
Oh
no, go ahead.
I think you're going to explain why that happened, right? Mm-hmm.
But yeah, go ahead, I'll let you.
I believe, like, just based off of what you're telling me, it seems like, first off, why was their Kickstarter goal that high? You know why they, what was their original Kickstarter goal? Do you remember?
It was, I think, like somewhere in like 200,000, maybe two, something like that. I can actually look that up very quickly here. Come on, load up. They were looking for, okay, they raised $334,000. They earned $250,000. This was a Canadian.
All right. I hope I don't get assassinated for saying this. We've talked about this before on the last Perceptive podcast. When your Kickstarter goal, the reason why people have that big of a Kickstarter goal, 200,000, quarter million, half a million, they're trying to, it's the scope of the game and how much they're paying people. Like, it's the scope of the game. So if you're noticing that they need that much money, then understand that they have a big budget. Like, they need that big budget. So even though I'm looking right now, it says, oh, yeah, us working with Gearbox is not why it went up. But it went up because they need to be able to compensate people. They need to be able to make the machine mm-hmm. still run. That it goes back to you can look at the funding goal and that give you an idea about the scope of the game. Now, mind you, sometimes that can be wrong. Like you have people might not put enough money on Kickstarter. They might say, oh, my game only needs 20,000. Actuality, dude, this was like $500,000 mm-hmm. game. You get what
yeah,
I'm
that
saying?
Happened. And, well, that actually happened with the developers of Too Dark, which was a little indie horror game that they raised. I think it was like €37,000, and this was supposed to pay for like 12 to 13 people working full time on a game for 3 years. Like, there's no way that money's going to cover all that.
Mm-hmm. They're tripping. Yeah. But I can look at this game right here, We Happy Few, and I'm like, this looks like something that's very, very AAA. That $200,000 that they wanted, I understand. And then that price hike, yeah, I understand. Now, you probably don't – what is the price of the game right
now?
It
was originally priced at $30 in early access. It has been raised to $50. And then when the game is released supposedly in April next year, it will go up to $60.
Right. Now – sometimes money doesn't easily equate to quality because you can also have time and stuff too. There's just different factors. But I'm looking at this game and I'm like, oh, yeah, yep, this right here, $200,000, makes perfect sense. This game being $50 makes perfect sense. Now, you can still make a good quality game and it can still be maybe like $25, $30. But that's when you got to look at like, yo, is it time? Is it money? Is it quality? This game looks like it has the quality just from screenshots and stuff. Mm-hmm. But just to the fans out there, when you see a game and it has that high of a budget, like for Kickstarter, look at what they're doing and see if that justifies. Actually, we talked about this before. Yeah, look to see if that justifies the funding goal.
Yep, and again, it's always tough to make that statement because I've spoken to a few developers in the past about, well, when we see Kickstarters are mainly used to basically pitch a game to a publisher, or that they've already received publisher-backed funds, such as Shenmue 3, Bloodstained, and there's probably a few other ones, Yooka-Laylee as well. And as we've said, it can be very hard sometimes to say, okay, this game's asking for $200,000 and looks like this, but this game is asking $300,000 and looks like 5-10 times better. Like, they will see that and go, well, you know, why does your game look so much horrible compared to this guy? But again, knowing what is actually going on behind the scenes and the work that's going into developing the game is a complete mystery for a lot of consumers.
Right, and go back to being transparent and what kind of company you're dealing with, too. Like, that AAA corporation, the PR person might not be able to say certain things, whereas me, we're an indie team. So like I said earlier, I told you, I said, yeah, this game. The demo was delayed by, and I still need to upload it too. The demo was up, like, I just finished the demo maybe about 3 hours ago, trying to make sure the level was loaded properly. That's why it was delayed by 12 hours. I can say that. Whereas, if I was like a PR person for, like, I don't know, that video game, that BioWare is doing Anthem or something, I'd be getting in a lot of trouble. So it goes back to being transparent, understanding the amount of transparency that you're willing to have with your fans and stuff. It's like building that understanding. Mm-hmm. As We Happy Few, or like even people going, like you said, people go to Kickstarter, right? And their intent is to get a publisher, right? So from a developer standpoint, I understand, like it seems smart. But then as a consumer, though, I understand too why a consumer would be mad about that. The consumer is probably originally, the whole point of Kickstarter was like for video games, right? Or the way Double Fine put it out was, hey, we don't want to go to a publisher. We want to be able to, you know, get the people they want. So, yeah, people are backing games on Kickstarter because they're like, they don't have to deal with that publisher, you know, red tape, the whole false advertisement, all that other stuff that goes with these AAA games. So I understand if a person feels cheated that, well, this game's getting a publisher? Like, are you serious? Like, I understand. So I see both sides of it.
Mm-hmm, definitely. But I think with that said, we'll probably start to wrap things up here. So we are just about approaching an hour and a half, and I think we could probably sit here and chat until sometime in the next few days. So
you're absolutely right about that.
So I guess to begin to wrap things up, I guess first off, when it comes to Bullock itself, is there or are there any parts of the game's design or where you're at in the development process that we didn't touch on earlier that you would like to talk about now?
Not really. Just like a quick update slash reminder. The demo today has revamped combat. So it's going to play differently. It's going to have better combos. More enemy types. So in this demo, you'll encounter an enemy Jaguar Knight. I don't believe that there was an Eagle Knight. Like I said before, I've been working on this for like a while now, so my mind's kind of blurred. Like, I'm not sure if there was an Eagle Knight present within the demo, but you'll deal with like the commoner level enemy. So there's more than just one enemy type you'll be dealing with. You'll also be able to fight in the Highlands. So you're not just, in the past, when we showed off screenshots or even with the demos, people were fighting in these cities, right? Which were painted with red. So it's going to be a change of scenery for players being able to play in Bullock. And then the campaign map too, there'll be more functionality to it, such as enemy movement. You're not going to, on this demo, you're not going to be able to customize your city. We have not added that yet. It's not ready to be given to the players. You'll just be able to move around the campaign map and choose where you want to, which city you want to attack. But when you conquer a city, though, it adds to your territory. So you do feel like that there is progression. This is a very early pre-alpha.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty much where we're at right now.
And as we've said over this cast, if you're looking to support Bullock when it comes on Kickstarter, the new estimated date is going to be February of 2018.
Yes, February 2018. We're going to release the game on Steam in 2019 and hopefully in 2020. Yes, I know 2020, right? It's 3 years from now. We'll be on the consoles after that. We will be going to the Square Enix Collective in January. So come January, the demo is going to be, there's going to be way more features added on. It's going to feel more cohesive.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And hopefully we'll be able to chat again before that, either another recorded cast or have you come back on for a live chat.
Yes, I look forward to it, Josh. As always, it's always good talking with you.
All right. So I think with that, we will be wrapping up for this week's Percepta podcast. Again, Trayvon, thank you so much for coming on. Again, it's always great hanging out with you. I mean, we're about an hour and a half in. We could probably sit here and talk for a few more hours. But again, definitely the best of luck with Bullock, and I'll be looking forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Josh. Thank you. Good talking to you.
Not a problem. So for you folks listening, be sure to keep an eye out for Bullock when it will be going on to Kickstarter. Probably, I'm not even sure when this cast will go up at this moment, but it should be going up in a few months by the time you're listening to it. And again, I'm sure Trayvon and I will be chatting before that as well. So, if you are new, thank you so much for listening to this week's Perceptive Podcast. If you'd like to support Game Wisdom, there are several options available. To write a guest piece for the site or be a future podcast guest, whether for a live or recorded chat, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. You can follow me on Twitter at GWBicer for updates for me throughout the day, as well as whenever I put votes and ask for suggestions. You can find the Game Wisdom YouTube channel where you'll be able to watch my daily videos on video games as well as design discussions. And of course, patreon.com/GWBicer. Your donations can help to keep things going. And you can get access to some little rewards like our private Discord channel or voting privileges and more. I guess before we go, Trayvon, for the social media side of things, do you have any places you would like to mention, like Twitter, Facebook, and so on?
I would say Twitter. It's Bullock Game, at Bullock Game on Twitter. And then the Facebook, you just type in Bullock. You gotta type in Bullock Modern Warfare or Bullock Game. And then there's my Instagram, which you see a lot of. Actually, on Instagram, if you want like a lot of updates on Bullock, like the day-to-day, hour-by-hour, go to Instagram and check out my Instagram story. It's Tenacious Trey. So Tenacious_Trey on Instagram, and you'll get more of Bullock.
Nice. So with that said, once again, thank you so much for listening to this week's Percepta podcast. Have a great rest of the week, and I will chat with you again next time. Take care.